Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hey folks, it's the Unsung Podcast. I am Mark.
Oh, the words are back.
The words are back.
That's nice. How did it feel going back to that?
Feel all right.
Aye?
Yeah, I don't hate it.
You don't feel that you're wasting your energy?
No. Who am I joined by? I'm joined by you, Chris.
You're joined by me. Who am I joined by?
You're joined by Kyle.
Chris, Kyle and Mark.
Kyle Wood, Lovers Turn to Monsters. Both a person and a band, a bit like Bright Eyes.
What's the one?
Often conflated with Conor Oberst alone, but actually a little bit more than that. You probably know that because you've been listening to the last two episodes. Mm-hmm. If you haven't been listening to the last two episodes, go and listen to the last two episodes. We've broken it down. We've gone through a little bit of the prehistory. We've gone through the catalogue. And we are quite quickly now going to dive into Digital Ash and A Digital Learn, which has been brought to the table by Kyle as the most unsung of the Bright Eyes records, despite acknowledging, I think, that it was pretty close to the bottom of most lists in terms of the best Bright Eyes records.
For sure, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Well, let's take a little tour of the material in this thing.
Cool, let's get into it.
And before we wade into Digital Ash and A Digital Learn, I think there's a couple of like elephants in the room we should mention. I know that 2016, his older brother Matt died. In Connor's own words, he basically fucking drank himself to death.
Well, later on, he said that was not quite, it wasn't quite clear what happened in a later interview, he said.
Right. But it affected them quite a bit. Mm. And the following year, he got divorced from his long-term partner as well. This is also a couple of years on the back of something we alluded to way at the fucking start of the first part of this. We were talking about poor Matthew Kelly. The rape allegation, or rather the false rape allegation against him, that was withdrawn by the woman that made it. So she called it 100% false. I'm not sure what the motivation for that was. However, I am aware of the fact that there's always an asterisk against Conor Oberst's name that has lingered on the back of hearing about that at the time. And it's that thing of like mud sticks, you know. Doesn't matter that he was completely exonerated, that the person said there's absolutely no truth to that allegation, and he came out and he actually was quite gracious about it, saying, you know, the vast majority of these things are true. I don't want to be any part of a conversation that says we should be skeptical about women reporting these things. I was unlucky. This is a rare example of a false allegation. It's been resolved. I've spoken to the person. It's done. I don't want to be held up by some men's rights groups as saying, you know, women are just out there to bring men down. That's actually a very fucking admirable response to that. But it is amazing that for me, I just knew I had a nagging doubt about the guy, and it is based on this, despite the fact that this is actually completely taken care of. That is a testament, I think, to the sullying power of those kind of things.
I think songwriters of that ilk in particular are very problematic people in the sense of, you know, drink abuse, whatever. There's certainly live videos of Connor being very kind of all over the place. He clearly struggles with his mental health. So when there is an allegation like that, it's hard not to be like, well, he seems like a head case. Of course he's going to have done something like that, you know what I mean? It's
when you're
it's,
in the public eye that much though, I mean, there's going to be videos. I mean, this guy has lived his life publicly for about 15 years at this point, since he's sort of broken through to, you know, touring with Bruce Springsteen and going on late night TV shows and, you know, calling up Emmylou Harris to fucking just come and play music with him. I mean, at that point, your life is documented. You go for a sandwich and people are like, fucking hell, Conor O'Bear's getting a sandwich. You're going to get caught at moments that are an opportunity, and you'd be able to build up a picture of anybody that has that much material of them living their lives, highs and lows, that could make them look either like a wonderful person or like a fairly odious person. But what matters is that the allegation, in the words of the person that made it, was completely false. And it's kind of important, I think, to try and remove that now for the conversation and just say, we've covered that, it's addressed, that should not factor into your thinking about Conor O'Bearst. Whatever you think about his vocal style, whatever you think about him drinking, whatever, anything like that, the rape allegation was false. The person says it's false. End of story. With that said, let's go and talk about
Digital Ash and Digital Learn.
And the Digital Learn. So, first of all, there's a few notable inclusions in terms of collaborators here. You get Nick Zinner of the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, does a fair bit on this. Got Maria Taylor of Azure Ray, she does vocals in a few places. And Nate Walcott does a lot of stuff. Nate Walcott went on to do films and things. He did The Fault in Our Stars, did the soundtrack for that. But he's also done records with Beck, The Shins, Maroon 5, U2, like the whole
Jellies, that's how they get, that's how they managed to get Flea and John Theodore on that record.
I think the record itself qualifies as Indietronica, and Bright Eyes have never been Indietronica up until this point, but it very much is. There's lots of, in particular, I look for like heavy compression and gain on snare sounds. They do that kind of plight augmented drum stuff, maybe even something that's sampled or triggered. The synthy pads that are early on, they actually really put me in the mind of that that post Bill Berry REM album Up, which opens with is this track called Airport Man, I think it is. That kind of weird plight synth use, there's nothing edgy about it. As I say, the drums really processed, the production comes much more to the fore, plays a more active role. I think as a result, this invites a lot of comparisons with Sparkle Horse, who really veered into that sound, you know, tracks like Applebed from It's a Wonderful Life in 2001.
I wish I had a horse's head, tiger's heart, an apple bed.
Now, I would suspect that Conor O'Bearst quite liked Sparkle Horse. I'm jumping to that conclusion, but that came out 3 years prior to this, 4 years prior to this, actually. And I would wager that there's maybe at least a part of him was somewhat influenced by this developing scene of Indietronica bands, in particular, like your Postal Services and like Sparkle Horse and stuff like that. But in terms of taking a wee tour through the tracks, I've already said that first one, Time Code, does, it's Airport Man from Up, a very sort of gentle, well, Airport Man's not entirely instrumental, but it's almost instrumental, and it's just a little atmospheric kind of warm thing. Kicks things off.
Yeah, it's an intro, isn't it? And straight away the chord progression on the keys is very Bright Eyes. Like, you know, you're still listening to Bright Eyes. It's still the exact same signature style of writing. Yeah, a lot of this record feels like the beefed up version of the lo-fi stuff, you know, with the drum machines and the synths and all that. It feels as though this is like the fully realised end point. If Bright Eyes had went in that direction, it would probably have been something like this, you know, back at the start of their career. Even the way the samples are deployed in this, or the crowd sounds and all that, it is very Bright Eyes. It's just deployed in a new way. Yeah, it's a nice, quietly atmospheric song, which I think...
And rather than opening with like a kind of almost a skit, though, he opens with something that's quite downbeat. And, you know, it's in keeping with the tone of the record.
And the theme.
Yeah, and the theme. Goldmine Gutted, the second track.
The drum mix is fucking wild in this song, man.
See, my first note is that I really enjoyed the drum mix and the panning in this one.
It's two drummers playing the same beat, yeah. And it's just slightly out of sync. It's in either channel.
It's a really nice beat. Yeah. It's a really nice bit of writing, actually.
A lot of the drums, I think, are one of the best things about the entire album. Like,
yeah, it does stand out way more, the drumming in this, than it has even in Lifted, which you were talking about. I think the chorus in this one actually is a really cute bit of sad melody. On all those hooded sweatshirt walks, we were a stroke of luck. We were a gold mine, they gutted us. The only beef I have with it is that I would have really loved that third organ note to ring out instead of just cutting the way they do. It's a musical decision, as I was saying, that I don't share, because actually I think the chorus is quite a nice payoff, but then the fact that you just don't sustain that third note, they pull it off. I'm like, ah, come on, let it resonate. But hey,
the synth bass sound is really good in this. I think generally over the course of the whole record, I know you say they're kind of polite synths, but I think those sounds are really well chosen and it works really well for them. The bit with the vocal from the sidelines, I see you run, I really fucking loved that bit, and it was a really, really catchy wee bit. Something quite affecting about the way it's delivered as well, which is at odds with the kind of digital sound that's mostly going on around about it. But yeah, the drum thing is really cool. I found it quite distracting at first because it's like,
well, it's on headphones in particular. Yeah, it's very, very noticeable.
And I was like, this is kind of strange because it's, are my headphones out of sync? What's going on here? You know,
the third track in it, Arc of Time. Until the clock speaks up, says it's time to go. You could choose the high or the lower road. Nicely arranged, pretty subtle as a tune, and actually it's really poppy, this one. The main melodic hook in it didn't really grab me all that much, but the delivery of it is really nice. So you nurse your love like a wounded dove in the covered cage of night. Every star is crossed. I couldn't help but think that this one sounded like an Indietronica Paul Simon.
And there's something wrong with that?
Perhaps not.
I really like this one as well. I actually did enjoy the vocal and the melody on it. There's some off-kilter harmonies or vocal double tracking that happens in it, which I think is something that Connor does deploy from time to time.
Yeah. He likes to sing over his own vocal a lot, and it makes that weird, like it's never a perfect match, and he enjoys that. It's like the Elliott Smith thing. It's been a recurring theme throughout his career, singing over his own voice and just leaving all the little
clashes. It's something that, again, I do creatively, and then going into a studio or working with a producer who doesn't get that vibe, and then I'm like, I do a take and they're like, you kind of like went over a bit there, and I'm like, yep.
That's designed.
I mean, because it would go against a lot of production instincts.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because whenever somebody wants to double track a vocal, it's like it's got to be exactly perfect. Yeah.
It's also you would often submerge one more, but he keeps them loud enough that they kind of trip over each other.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think that seems to be, again, you were saying can be quite distracting, but I think production wise, I think it's all supposed to sound like it's tripping over itself, like this entire album.
Oh no, I think that's like, he's done it so many times, it's clearly a deliberate thing. Yeah. Down in a rabbit hole. I heard you fell into a rabbit hole, covered yourself up in snow. Baby, tell me where'd you go. Days and days. I actually thought that this song was a reference to someone being obsessively lost in the internet, but then there's a reference to drug use in it, and I suppose the two can go hand in hand. The song itself, I just found it a bit glum. It didn't really connect.
Reminds me of there's an interview with Connor, kind of like how he's on Craig Ferguson, I think it is, and he gets interviewed, and it's the most condescending interview you can ever possibly imagine. And he asks him what type of music. Well, like, what do you like? And Conor Roberts, like, oh, listen to like a lot of Leonard Cohen. And he leans in and goes, awfully sad, isn't it?
That is very Craig Ferguson, isn't it?
Glum. Just the word glum.
Glum. I mean, it is kind of glum. I mean, he's done this thing as well where they've used some quite fancy strings.
Yeah, they're real strings as well. See the moon, we're invisible.
Yeah, they're offset against this lo-fi electronic glitchy feedback noise that they keep using. So you've got a bit of the high tech and the low tech there, which is an interesting mix. I just don't necessarily think there's much of a song beneath it, you know.
I like that aspect of it. The beat is kind of hip-hoppy as well. There's a really heavily processed guitar solo, which I quite enjoyed. It's an element that I think works really well when it's nestled underneath the strings in this song. And then there's a female vocal around 3:07, which is doubled up, and it just keeps going. It's a really lush outro. I like this song. I like the ambition of this song. It makes sense for the people that had written Lifted to kind of try and bring in some elements of that grandiosity, you know.
Take It Easy, fifth one. This was a single.
First with your hands, then with your mouth, a downpour of sweat, damp cotton clouds. I was a fool, you were my friend, we made it happen.
Beneath the production in this, I think it sounds like a really archetypal Bright Eyes song. The production is really ramped up though, and it's trying to differentiate it.
Well, that weatherman's alive, he said it'd be raining, but it's clear and blue as far as I can see.
There's a fun wee, I think it's like almost like a whistle sound that has the bit of the playfulness of a band like Grandaddy, so it's a little bit lighter in tone as a result.
I think that's one of the tracks that Jimmy Tamborello done the electronics on it, the Postal Service, which again makes sense of the differentiation between production on that standing out.
Can't make you live, you're a beautiful boy, you're a sweet little kid.
I think it's probably like the weakest track on the album, but it's a single, so
yeah, it's an odd choice, because Hit the Switch, the sixth track, is the one that I recognise from repeated play in the wider world. It's like kind of total cafe song.
'Cause there's this switch that gets hit, and it all stops making sense. And in the middle of drinks, maybe the fifth or the sixth, I'm completely alone.
It does the same thing with the drums as track three, with the two different drummers playing variations of the same beat.
Why do you think that wasn't chosen as a single?
It might have been to do with the Jimmy Tamborello being a part of like Take It Easy, like I guess like Postal Service on the name. But
Bright Eyes is already a bigger deal than Postal Service.
And Hit the Switch is probably my favourite Bright Eyes song.
It's just a really standout stick on single candidate to me, and it's the fact that it's one of those tracks. We spoke a wee bit again, sorry to bring up REM, but the track Star 69 from Monster was never released as a single, but it got radio play because people just wanted it to get played. And this to me is similar. It's like I hear this regularly on playlists, and yet it's never been used as a promotional tool for the record. It's just kind of strange.
Offers expired, I have been less than frequent. She's under no obligation to indulge every whim, and I'm so ungrateful. I take, she gives and forgives, and I keep forgetting it.
I like the richness and instrumentation in this one. It's just a really captivating song. It's got a harmonised guitar solo with two completely different guitar tones, which is lovely.
I think, again, when I'm speaking about the weakness of it, I think I was saying at my like kind of first point of opinion on this album, lyrically, like I recognise Conor Oberst has a very certain style that doesn't fit a lot of people. Some people can roll an eye at it or whatever, but I think there's like a real difference in the lyrics on this album. Like there seems to be like a lot more weight and a lot more kind of thought, and I think Take It Easy obviously feels a bit more, as you said, like archetypal, like it's just fell out of him and he's been like, get that one on the record, boys.
Yeah, no, like I said, I think Hit the Switch is a better song, and those elements that I mentioned definitely are more interesting than what happens in Take It Easy.
Talking about elements, I believe in symmetry. Mm-hmm. If you do not like Conor Oberst's voice, this is not the track for you.
So I raise my glass to symmetry, to the second hand and its accuracy,
to the actual size of everything. The desert is the sand. You can't hold it in your hand.
This feels like more like a traditional Bright Eyes tune almost.
Yeah, I mean, but this is a much more interesting drum panning. You know, that's a kind of technique that's very much of this record. There's some cool guitar work at the end, actually.
Yeah, tremolo stuff is really good.
Yeah, it's complemented by strings that give it a bit of an epic air. It seems like a lot of energy went into this tune. So again, it's a little bit odd that it isn't a promo. But in terms of, you know, as a song itself, I'm not massively moved by it, but I do recognise that they've poured quite a lot of effort.
The way the strings are mixed in the song makes it kind of feel as though they're like a bubble around the song. You know, it's a really interesting production track because they're submerged, but not. I think it's hard to submerge strings really because they are, take up so much like,
it's like a,
space.
It's like a good word I'd say for this album in general, like submerged. It does, it feels very... like it feels like Hangover, basically.
Mm. Yeah, it does. It totally does.
Like that's like,
yeah, you know.
No, I really like. I like those guitar parts at the end as well. The different drum beat thing, it keeps happening, and by this point, I'm kind of used to it, and I was really getting into the way that's done.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
So... Devil in the Details, track 8, I think actually has a really decent hook in the pre-chorus, that no backing out bit that drops out. Does that again later on with different words. The harp's a kind of interesting inclusion. Song's totally fine, but again, I think it's a very typical Bright Eyes four chord progression. It probably has a fair bit of poignancy for fans of the band, it's safe to say, but you know, that Spanish phrase, toca la patata, doesn't really touch my potato. Yeah. My, it doesn't really move me.
I really like that song. It's kind of a lot more introspective. It feels like it's underwater almost, going back to that kind of submerged feeling. It's also in, I think it's in 3-4, and there's like white noise creeping around the edges of the whole song, which again make you feel like it's in a bubble. No, I really like the feel of that song. There's something about it that I just gravitated towards. Mm-hmm. You know,
I mean, I have to say, by track 9, Shipping a Bottle, I'm getting a wee bit mired in the low key melancholy.
I wanna be the house that you were raised in, the only place that you feel safe. I wanna be a shower in the morning that wakes you up and makes you clean.
I feel the record could have used a wee bit of a gear change here. And the lyrics in this one are simple but cute. You know, that stuff about wanting to be the shower that wakes you up in the morning, but instead just being the weather at your window. Some really nice turns of phrases there, but the tune itself for me is a total shrug, and I'm getting a wee bit tuned out. You know,
I was going to say that's one of my faves on it, probably, strength wise.
There we go. That's the kind of plurality of opinion that you tune in this podcast for.
It reminds me of Elvis Costello in places with the upstroke guitars, like a really kind of 80s feel. I don't know where that thought came from. I don't even know if he would ever cite Elvis Costello as an influence.
Well, I can see that probably as like just from a songwriting perspective. Mm-hmm.
It's cool. It's kind of a subtle song in places. Yeah, the baby cries though.
Yeah, that's always like, it's like such a stupid thing, but every time it happens, I'm like, oh, done it again, boys.
You know that you were saying you thought someone was in the house earlier on because of the footsteps in a song. Did you think you'd had a Wayne?
No, thank God.
Track 10, Light Pollution. So this is probably the gear change that I think could have come earlier.
Yeah.
Johnny Hobson was a good man. Books and mic stands. He even got me a subscription to the Socialist Review.
It's sort of a light rocker, you know, it shakes things up a bit. As I was saying though, I think when Indytronica tries to rock out, it feels quite constrained. Mm-hmm. Like it's like the guardrails when you're bowling. You know what I mean? It's like you can never really go too wrong.
And freedom yells, but don't cry. Whatever sells will decide. But there's no hell when you die, so don't look so worried.
The production style kind of hampers it a wee bit, so it'll never actually get heavy or raucous. So when I say it feels rocky, I mean that in a very qualified sense. The drums are still really heavily processed, and you know, you can hear there's electronic percussion comes mm-hmm. in this quite a bit. But yeah, it doesn't get as noisy as it feels like it wants to be, and melodically I didn't get any real emotional punch. I do think the ending was quite nice though. The ending of the song is pretty strong.
It is, yeah, more straight song, I think. It's more emo than anything else, that one. It didn't really grab me too much, if I'm honest, either. It feels as though it needed to go up another gear. It does have a fun build-up around 1 minute 56, but I felt as though it needed something a bit more.
It's my favourite song in the album.
Is it?
It's what?
It's my favourite song in the album.
It's what? Your favourite. You know, the gate's going to cut that out, so just be loud and proud.
It's my favourite song in the album.
Why?
I think there's just something about the chorus. I'm obsessed with the lyric, there's no hell when you die, so don't look so worried.
Mm-hmm. It's a good lyric, to be fair.
Yeah, just the way everything builds up around the chorus. The synths are all like swirling, and again, it feels kind of like the idea of it being submerged when the chorus comes in, like it feels...
It breaches and gets into the fresh air.
Yeah, yeah.
Theme to Pinata, the 11th track, is a little bit of a Latin.
See, this is what I was waiting for. The strain in your voice, as you see, as we get to each next track.
So yeah, Latin jazz or something when it kicks in. Man, I mean, this song just does not happen for me at all. It feels completely pointless, I'm sorry. And I would just go straight into the Easy Lucky Free as a 12th track. I'm definitely a little bit drained at this point because it's a 50-minute album. And I think 50 minutes, as we've probably established on the show, is beyond my sweet spot, especially for subdued music like this. I mean, Theme to Pinata didn't need to be on here at all. I think that the last track, Easy Lucky Free, is definitely both a bit better and a bit...
That's my favourite song on the record.
Yeah, and it's a lot more interesting than a few that precede it. I kind of wanted to give it a fair hearing, but I reckon if it had come sooner, it would probably fare better as a tune because I'm just a bit fatigued. That said, the melodic choices were different songwriters and consumers, clearly. The choices he makes don't really make sense to me, or they do make sense, but they don't push any buttons.
Well, Easy Lucky Free, I think that was quite a well-known single as well,
yeah,
wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, for sure. Listening for patterns in the sound of an endless...
It's just a really good song. I think the keys are great. The overall synth sounds are really well chosen. The lead guitar and the verse is awesome.
Again, the drums are like a major, major part of it as well.
Yeah, it's got the strongest vocal melody, I think, on the record. The bridge, the way the bridge goes into the chorus is quite 80s. The synth sounds are quite 80s, which is cool. It's just the chorus is simple but effective for me. And no, I really... It's a strong end to the record, but I think, you know, I'm kind of with Chris in the sense of like 50 minutes is probably too long. I'm a punk guy, so like 30 minutes is always going to be my sweet spot.
I'm a fan of 42. That seems to be my...
It's an odd one for me because I'll argue and be like, oh, this is too long. I want like short, sharp songs. But then like I listen to a 52-track Sebado record. I think like...
Contrary.
Yeah, that's the word.
Yeah, that is.
Arsehole. And no, I think I enjoy wading through things. Is
doesn't everybody? I mean, you like baths.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like being submerged in things, don't you?
Like I enjoy, and I think that album, knowing the context of it as well, of like losing a friend and whatever, and trying to kind of navigate your way through that, it feels like it's maybe, obviously, they're not a band that love a short album, but I think that one's it's supposed to kind of feel like wading through the
like
through
an endurance.
Yeah, yeah. Which I think is an interesting thing when it's done purposely. It can work like really, really super well. So
do you just want to hear my conclusion?
Yeah.
On Bright Eyes. Want to wrap this up? This is what you've been waiting for. This is what it was all about. Did you put money on this, we hope? I think with regards to this record, I think after years of hearing this sort of production, you know, the more Indietronica thing, including plenty of bands, I think spending far too much time focusing on that and not on the tunes, you know, actually relying on it to mask the tunes sometimes. I've ironically learned to tune this sort of approach to production out. It doesn't impress me. I think it was probably pretty striking at the time, but those kind of things move fast, you know, and the novelty of this may have felt even slightly cutting edge, but it certainly doesn't feel slightly cutting edge now. So I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to put myself in the headspace of 2005 to try and give it a fairly balanced appraisal. It was certainly a bit of a bold move by the band to do this, albeit it was a bold move that, as I mentioned, a lot of other bands had already taken 3, 4, 5 years prior to that. They probably enjoyed it as a break from their norm. They also had the safety net of having another album out at the exact same time that had more of their conventional sound to it if people didn't click with this. But given that the production doesn't really strike me as particularly remarkable now, listening to it in 2024, I don't feel there's an awful lot of great songwriting behind it. There are moments, but there's a lot of really quite standard Bright Eyes stuff that I just feel like Conor Oberst could write with his eyes shut. As I said, more generally, the melodic decisions that Bright Eyes make just don't marry with my own preferences or instincts. I can hear how someone would relate to it and be moved. I can see what it's doing. You know, I'm not blind to that. But those changes, those decisions, those transitions, they don't resonate with me, barring on a few rare occasions, and I've kind of highlighted some of them as we've gone along. As a reference, I think I had that same issue with a lot of Sparkle Horse, more generally, but they clicked more regularly with me. And when they clicked, they really clicked with me in a way that Bright Eyes has never done. So yeah. But Bright Eyes, to me, are, especially during this record, are in a similar place in terms of what they're going for, but it's an inferior product.
Mm. I've really enjoyed listening to Bright Eyes this past week or two. I was saying to you last night, Kyle, I was kind of dreading it. I always get that when it comes to artists with larger catalogues, because it can stop being fun. Doing this can stop being fun really quickly.
Again, I'd also just like to at this point say that you said to me, I thought you would have chose like Guided by Voices.
Yeah, which would have been like,
good luck with that.
Yeah,
know, 36 albums.
Yeah,
or
that was the fear.
Chris, that is way off. It's, I think they've got 52 studio albums, and that's just under the name Guided by Voices.
Shitting hell!
Yeah, that's the one.
Mark, shut your mouth! Yeah,
because I know you like Guided by Voices, and when I was
speaking of wading through things,
yeah, I was, and when I suggested maybe getting you on the show to Chris, I was like, you could do Guided by Voices, and I knew when I said that, I was like, I really don't want to do Guided by Voices. I really don't want to do that, or fucking the Mountain Goats or something as well, you know. But that being said, Sparkle Horse I really enjoyed, but because this plays more my sensibility as a musician, as a consumer of this kind of music, as somebody that likes both alt country and emo, like this ticks all the boxes for me. Mm. And then you get some weird shit like this, which is cool too,
and makes the
journey worthwhile. You know, I don't think it's their best record. I probably would say that as the unsung record for sure.
What do you think's their best record out of Kiros?
I think Lifted is probably their best record.
Okay, the 71-minute album.
Yeah, uh-huh.
From the guy that likes 34-minute punk rock records.
Yeah, that's the irony, isn't it? Like,
it's fucking contrary bastards by the two of yous.
As you know, like when I'm listening to a discography of an artist, I listen to the album we're doing last, but also as I'm going through it, I'll just like pick songs I like it immediately and put them on a playlist.
Okay.
Most of them came for Lifted.
Mm-hmm. So, you know. If you'd asked me before this show to guess, I would have said, I think Mark will really like this. And so I think
I did like it.
You did like it. But I just mean even the band more generally. I know you said you kind of went, you got into them and then got out of them pretty quickly. But it does, to me, make sense that you would enjoy this. Did you think I was going to like it?
No.
That's good that you came into my house knowing that you'd pick something that you thought I was going to dislike, that I've now talked about for 2 hours and that I had to study for a full fucking week.
Yeah,
thanks.
Definitely, that was the vibe.
So
how's your hangover, you prick? I mean, I didn't hate it. I don't hate Bright Eyes, and they've got some good moments.
I think, like, knowing the art you create and all that, I knew it would maybe not be to your sensibilities, but I knew that you would be able to, like, recognise the pros of it and, like, where Conor Oberst fits in the kind of grander scheme of things and all that. So
how has it felt for you getting back to Bright Eyes and discography?
He's fucking 24/7.
I know. It's one of the. It's kind of like again. I was speaking earlier about watching all the Martin Scorsese's films. I was like watching them. I was like, why am I watching all these again? I've watched these so many times. Like,
he is wallowing in a big old bath of Bright Eyes.
Yeah,
you know.
So, and again, and I was like, I thought Unsung Podcast over here. I was like, I've listened to all the solo albums. Listened to Commander Venus. Listened to Park Avenue. You have done none of that. Yeah.
No, I have, mate. Trust me. Look at the fucking lines in my face, man. I have this week.
Totally caught up.
You seem very glum.
Tell you what I've done, though. I have done a really rather excellent Nexus.
I did mine with a hangover this morning, so it's not going
to
be good.
I tried to do one with a hangover and then fell asleep for 2 hours.
Right.
Fair enough. Totally fair enough.
Nexus time, then.
A complicated series of connections between different things.
This week's Nexus was chosen by Davey Bright.
Fucking Davey Bright, man.
Oh, Davey Bright, what are the chances?
I'm sure he's never heard that before.
And the person picked for it is Ron Athey, a performance artist. Into a lot of like sort of reflections on S&M and extreme body art.
He shoved a baseball bat up his arse. That was a thing he did as part of an art exhibition.
Does that count as extreme these days?
That's what I was saying to Danny. Because Danny was looking, she was like, I said, have you ever heard of this guy? Because I know he's done body modification. She's a piercer.
Yeah.
And she was like, no. And then she googled it and it's like, nah, I've not heard of this guy. But I don't really want to hear this guy.
I was going to say extreme. What was everybody else doing last night?
I don't want to make it out that he's a freak show, because I mean, some of it does have a bit of this sort of Jim Rose thing to it, but at the same time, a lot of it's also very strongly about pushing back against the conservative right in the States. It's about LGBTQ rights and platforming and visibility. So it's high art, you know. It's got some very complicated shows and stuff, and he's collaborated with a lot of different people, so it's not a pure, oh my god, look at that fucking weird guy with a bat up his ass. This is not like Two Girls One Cup. This is like a really interesting performance artist who's done a lot of really cool stuff and stood up against a lot of pretty odious people as well. Kyle, you brought this to the table, so you're the one that goes first in the Nexus.
No, I failed. I've not.
Fucking.
That's what I'm saying. I tried and then
fell asleep.
I got like two steps and then was like, my brain just went into, I always go backwards and then kind of like forward type thing. So I was like, the performing artist was in a performing art film with a guy who was in tons of like Madonna music videos. So I then got to like him to Madonna.
I had dinner next to one of Madonna's pals the other night.
Oh.
And the whole time through dinner, I was like, who is this? I don't know her. Who is this? And that's who it was.
As I'd meant to bring
up. She was in Goodfellas.
Wild. I was going to bring up earlier, I got really drunk when I was a big drinker and met Kevin Devine's band. Oh. They played at the Garage.
I like Kevin.
And I was speaking to his bass player and I was telling him, I was like, oh, I'm a musician, I make music. Like, do you I know you're playing bass, but you like a musician and that yourself? And he was like, yeah. And he told me his name and I wrote it on my hand. And then the next day, it was one of the founding members of Mercury Rev. And I was like, do you do the music stuff yourself?
Didn't tell him what I think of the singing. All right, Mark, you or I?
Yeah, I'll go first. So as noted earlier, Bright Eyes covered Elliot Smith. Before going solo, Elliot Smith's in a band called Heat Miser.
Mm-hmm.
The guitarist in Heat Miser was a guy called Neil Gust.
By the way, Heat Miser fans, there's a re-release of a whole bunch of their early stuff. I think came across it in Asai the other day. It's rather smashing looking bit of vinyl.
Neil Gust has been a guest on Turned Out a Punk by Damien Abram from Fucked Up, really good podcast. He's done over 300 episodes. He's had loads of guests from like
300 episodes, big fucking deal, mate.
He's had loads of like guests from all, like not just like music and musicians, but like directors and all that as well. One of those guests
we've had Kyle.
We've had Kyle. We've got Kyle.
We've had Grant.
We've had Grant.
These are the household names of tomorrow.
Yeah,
like Fred West.
One of his guests was Jamie Stewart from, is it Zoo?
Yeah.
They're an experimental band. They've done a lot of music. Recently,
they've done a lot of music. Son, Kyle would say to the guy from Mercury, then.
Wait a second, I'm just talking about a lot of music. The next connection is a lot of music. They've done a collaboration with Mersbow, who's done a lot of fucking music.
He's done a lot of noise.
Yeah, I think he's released like in excess of 500 records or something.
Yeah,
like that.
But yeah, when you're just recording static, that's fucking easy.
Yeah, so. Again, we went down the Guided by Voices route here. Yeah. Come back when you're writing a dynamite melody every time.
No, I mean, Guided by Voices have to at least agree on when to start, stop, and what notes to play. Mersbo just doesn't. Mersbo just unplugs the cable and chews it for a while and then puts it out as an album.
In 2020, I believe, he did a collaboration record with Mike Patton called Maldoror, M-A-L-D-O-R-O-R, Maldoror, Maldoror.
It's five different versions of that word.
Yeah, I don't fucking know.
Sounds good.
I don't know. I mean, it's
pronunciation.
It's Mersbow, so it's not going to sound particularly good. In 2008, Mike Patton helped curate the All Tomorrow's Paris Festival. One of the bands that he picked were the no-wave band Teenage Jesus and the Jerks.
I was at that.
Which had Lydia Lunch on guitar and vocals. That's the only time they performed since they broke up in 1979, which is pretty cool.
No, I was at it. Was it not that good?
Was it not?
No, I mean, the festival was pretty good, but it had Mike Patton picks Mike Patton projects.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're just like, why the fuck am I standing down here paying good money to listen to broken
just
fucking
Mike Patton in general?
So in 2011, the performance artist Empress Sta, an artist, aerialist, cabaret performer, producer, and director. She's done quite a lot of famous stage shows in America, and her career spans 27 years, and she performed at the Spill Festival of Performance in a show called Empress Star in Space, which was directed by Ron Athey and featured guest performances from Lydia Lunch and Peaches.
All right, okay.
There we go.
There we go.
I think actually as well, when I done the Madonna thing, also for some unknown reason, got to like the guy, that model, Tony Ward, I think he's called Tom Ward, was in a Lisa Marie Presley video. And then I was like, Lisa Marie Presley, Michael Jackson, Macaulay Culkin. Surely Macaulay Culkin could be related to Bright Eyes in some way, shape or form.
Probably.
like, and that was, so this is where
Macaulay Culkin was in the video for Sunday by Sonic Youth.
There we go. You're pretty much bang on.
Oh, we almost did it off the top of our heads. Mm. Instead, I've got a belter, so get comfy. Ron Athey, we spoke about
Nazis.
Already. No, I've got some Jews, but no Nazis. So, Bright Eyes Band.
Bright Eyes, in brackets, band.
The name Bright Eyes does not come from the lyrics to Total Eclipse of the Heart by Bonnie Tyler. Nor does it come from, is it Art Garfunkel's song about rabbits?
Adam and Phelim.
It has nothing to do with that, apparently. It's just a compliment. But it's also the name of Charlton Heston's character in Planet of the Apes. Bright Eyes, yep. From 1968.
Again, just kismet. I've also been watching all the Planet of the Apes films. I'm like four Planet of the Apes deep this week.
How many baths?
I've been watching them at work, actually.
Oh.
So
having a
in
bath.
My bath. My work doesn't have a bath.
How many baths are in them?
Oh, one.
One.
The player Escape from Planet of the Apes are trying to show like that the apes are having like a lovely time, so Zira has like a bubble bath.
Oh, goodness me. Charlton Heston also played Moses in The Ten Commandments.
Bit of an odious prick, to be fair.
In 1956. Moses? Really? he put the work in.
Big Charlie.
Anyway, so he played Moses. The original Great Seal of the United States of America, by the way, it's not a seal as in like one that lives in the water. That's like the seal, the big badge thing. The original one featured Moses with his hand outstretched over the Red Sea, closing the waters to destroy the Pharaoh's army. When the USA declared independence in 1776, a committee was set up to design the seal that would be used on all official documents as well as just general merchandising, you know, because like 18th century t-shirts were big news. But that heavyweight glamour committee featured Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Benjamin Franklin. So it's top shelf celebs there.
Founding fathers.
For the record, Moses was chosen over Adams' suggestion of Hercules, which Adams himself thought, nah, actually, that's pretty cheesy, apparently.
Was that a direct quote from John Adams?
John Adams.
Apparently so.
Bit cheesy, mate.
Yeah, that was in the back of the T-shirt.
I've just got his image of like Moses, like just a big hand, I guess, to seal.
He's almost in a Nazi salute, so I guess that could be it. But on the picture, yeah, he's got his kind of hand out like this over the water. Anyway, they chose Moses because they also felt that the Pharaoh was emblematic of King George of England and obviously declaring independence from the Redcoats, all that kind of stuff. But for the record, in 1783, after three different committees all tried to come to a final decision, that seal was eventually changed in favour of the one with the eagle that you probably recognise from today. You know, the eagle kind of looking off to the side and the one that's on the front of the plinth and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, Benjamin Franklin, who was part of those committees, is the face of the $100 bill. It's all about the Benjamins. Or at least he should be the face of the $100 bill, because in 1992, the band Porno for Pyros, which rose from the ashes of Jane's Addiction, that band came up with a really novel idea for some audience interaction during their live shows when they were touring their debut album in 1993. They printed up fake $100 bills featuring Perry Farrell's face, the singer's face, instead of Benjamin Franklin, and they would hand them out at the gigs during this song. And one fan apparently successfully used the fake note to pay for his meal at a Denny's in Tampa, Florida, after the Tampa show. The restaurant reported it, and the feds arrived, they held interviews, they took the note, and the next day, just before the show in Miami, the band was arrested and detained for counterfeiting. Bear in mind, this is notes with Perry Farrell's face instead of Benjamin Franklin, and apparently they were like dead papery bullshit, so they were eventually released without charge after hours of being detained, and their manager publicly made a joke about it. They were all going to go to Denny's instead to get dinner and spend the last of their fake notes. So the 1994 song Sadness by Porno for Pyros. Was actually re-recorded and re-released as A Little Sadness. And there was a new video made for it, and the controversial video was made under the art direction of Mr. Ron Athey, the performance artist. He adapted one of his productions called Four Scenes from a Harsh Life, and he also included the bit where they called it the human printing press, where they cut symbols into a guy's back and then press fabric on it to sort of create these blood images. Now, this was actually part of like what got him in a lot of hot water. That exact production led to a dispute with what they called the NEA4, which was a group of ultra-conservative culture warrior figures in the 1990s USA, who were pushing back basically against any sort of public funding for work that they felt promoted LGBTQ lifestyles. And they also had this thing, it was Jerry Falwell, one of those kind of guys. The headlines in the paper were, this printing press thing exposed the entire audience to HIV infected blood.
I remember reading about that bit, actually.
Yeah, so that was a big deal. But yeah, so Ron Athey was brought in to art direct that Porno for Pyros video.
Ooh. Nice.
Next is complete.
That's pretty good, yeah. Well, thank you for joining us, Kyle. Hopefully it's not been too torturous for you.
No, thank you for having me.
It was good to get into Bright Eyes.
It's good to get out of Bright Eyes as well. Mark, what are we going to cover for the next episode?
I don't know, Chris, it's your choice.
Oh, funnily enough, we are going to cover Fever Ray. Mark, Kyle, while you're here, would you like to pull a name from that little tub there for the Nexus? Yep, prove it's real.
Foley effects there.
Let's see. Good luck reading this.
Yeah.
It is a German name, I'm assuming, so it's Rudolf van Hackel. That's it.
It's exactly as the boy says it, Rudolf von Hackelheber, courtesy of Kenny Bonella.
Who is it?
Cryptonomicon, Rudolf Rudy von Hackelheber, a non-Nazi German.
Oh, there are a few I've heard.
What an incredibly insulting synopsis there. So yeah. He's a character in a book called Cryptonomicon.
Okay.
Which is a 1989 novel by American author Neal Stephenson, set in two different time periods. Maybe the challenge would be for me to do this Nexus and not mention Nazis.
That should be the challenge.
Okay, yeah. Let's make it so.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, see you next week. Thanks a lot, Kim.
Bye. Thank you, babe.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.